Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Good evening. I've been expecting you. Won't you join me?
While everybody will be out this October 31st celebrating Reformation Day and the 500th anniversary of Martin Luther's famous 95 Theses that started a Protestant Revolution, we here at Research on Religion want to take a little time out to observe a lesser-known holiday, Halloween. Yes, some of you may have heard of it, a time when gremlins and goblins come out in polyester costumes and beg for large quantities of corn syrup. For the past 7 years here on the show, we've actually been taking a break from our normal fare of discussing social scientific findings related to traditional religion and using the week of All Hallows' Eve to talk about things supernatural that are a bit outside the box, ooky, kooky, and spooky. In the past, we've talked about Bigfoot, UFOs, ancient astronauts, zombies, and all sorts of other historical monsters, human sacrifice, and even the funeral business in the United States. Today, we continue that tradition with a discussion of zombies, Cylons, and the apocalypse. What could be more fun? To help us with that task, my guest today is Professor Robert Joustra, a recently promoted Associate Professor in International Studies at Redeemer University College in Ancaster, Ontario, Canada, where he also serves as the Director of the Center for Christian Scholarship. Dr. Joustra is an Editorial Fellow at the Review of Faith and International Affairs, and a Fellow with the Washington, D.C. think tank, the Center for Public Justice. Robert has written or edited a number of books, including God and the Global Order, The Power of Religion in American Foreign Policy, The Church and Religious Persecution, and very recently, The Religious Problem with Religious Freedom. A year ago, he co-authored another book with Alyssa Wilkinson entitled How to Survive the Apocalypse, Zombies, Cylons, Faith, and Politics at the End of the World. That is our topic for today. Beyond all this academic-y stuff, Robert also has written for the Globe and Mail, the National Post, Books and Cultures, and numerous other popular media outlets. Before joining academia, he worked for nearly a decade in politics with the think tank Cartist, and previously served the Christian Reformed Church's Committee to Study Religious Persecution and Liberty. Our trick will be to link all this other stuff on the website for your treat. Robert, welcome to Research on Religion, and happy Reformation Day.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Now, hey, given your work with the Christian Reformed Church, the obvious question of whether or not you're going to dress up as Martin Luther or perhaps John Calvin for Halloween this year, is that what you're going to do?
Oh, definitely. And I think the clear choice there has to be Martin Luther. First, because I could show up mainly disheveled, but second, because I could also show up mostly drunk, and it would just be an authentic costume.
Yeah, Calvin is probably not a fun costume. Everybody recognizes Martin Luther, although Calvin had the bigger influence on the Reformed Church. But nobody, you know, Calvin just, you know, no dancing or anything like that. It's not fun.
So, that's right. Yeah.
Well, your recently released book, The Religious Problem with Religious Freedom, looks like a great read and hits upon one of our favorite topics here at Research on Religion, which is religious liberty. So we might need to get you back to talk about that one, but the book that really caught my eye was this one you wrote with Alyssa Wilkinson of King's College in New York, and it's called How to Survive the Zombie Apocalypse. No, actually, How to Survive the Apocalypse. There's a lot of different apocalypses you could survive, I found out. Now, here's the question I have for you. You're a political science guy. How did you ever come up with this idea to write a book that talks about zombies and Cylons?
Yeah, it's a bit of an unusual take. There's no question about it. I think this is, I sort of refer to this book as kind of the other project. While I was actually working on the Religious Problem with Religious Freedom book, I was working on a number of projects with my friend Alyssa Wilkinson, and watching just a ton of sort of TV and movies. She was chief film critic for Christianity Today at the time. Now she writes, she does the main film gig for Vox Online. And we just ended up kind of coordinating and talking about some of the research we were doing and finding out that actually there was an awful lot of overlap between what we were looking at, between some of the films and the movies and the TV shows she was looking at and some of the kind of, vaguely sort of apocalyptic stuff I was studying in the kind of political science literature on the meaning of the secular and the sort of, a transformation in age and that kind of thing. And both of us were sort of, at the time, sort of taken with Charles Taylor and some of his approaches, but we thought, one of the things about Taylor's The Secular Age, one of the things that sort of challenges people, it's just this great, big, huge book, and it's really, really hard to get an insight into it. I mean, you've got to kind of have a doctoral degree and spend a summer working through the thing to make sense of it. But we found lots in it that was sort of, helpful. And we wondered if there might be a kind of narrative or popular way to demonstrate some of the things he talks about in that book. And that basically ends up being the structure of How to Survive the Apocalypse. It's basically a kind of a pop culture read of some of Taylor's insights in A Secular Age. And you kind of go blow by blow through some of these sort of things that he talks about. And we talk about movies or TV shows that actually work out what Taylor is sort of getting at in his book, at least in our opinion.
Yeah, we're going to talk about Charles Taylor here in a second because the book Secular Age is monumental, and I would also say it's a slog. It's a hard read, and it's extremely thick. But we will talk about that in a second here. You mentioned that you were watching movies at the time when you're writing your other work. A lot of the stuff in this book is more contemporary kind of stuff. We're going to talk about Battlestar Galactica, The Walking Dead, and things like that. But when you were growing up, did you ever get into monster movies? I was a huge fan of Godzilla, Creature of the Black Lagoon, and anything UFO. I just love that kind of stuff. Was that part of your upbringing?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Alyssa and I both grew up as nerds. What we were allowed to watch. Both of us also grew up in, I would say, media-managed households, which is probably more important today than it even was when we were growing up. I was allowed to watch things like Star Trek, Battlestar Galactica. I got really into the kind of sci-fi sort of fantasy genre stuff, which at the time when I was growing up wasn't cool, but it's been very cathartic to watch it become kind of mainstream and cool. And so we had this huge sort of nerdy backstory to stuff that we just loved digging into. So for us, it was actually, a real joy to kind of go blow by blow through some of the stuff, which was now very popular and very contemporary, but brought us back to stuff we were loving when we were kids.
Now, was this hard to sell to a publisher? Because I should mention that you went with Erdemans, and they're a religious publisher, and if you go to their website, and we'll link over to their website, you'll see stuff on Karl Barth or T.S. Lewis or other folks like that. The living dead walking the earth does not seem to be their bag. How'd you get connected with them?
We really enjoyed working with Erdmans on this, actually. We really wanted to work through a press like Erdman, particularly because we thought the book, and because these ideas of the apocalypse were actually really religious. And we wanted to kind of have, not only as our kind of like editors and reviewers, but also as our readers, people who kind of had their religious antennae up for thinking about pop culture and thinking about Taylor. And Erdmans had done a kind of little book that Jamie Smith had done on Charles Taylor as well, and it was a kind of little introductory work that Jamie did, and we liked that, but we thought that using pop culture as an entry into Taylor, first of all, was so improbable because I mean Taylor is so sort of like monumentally, as you said, dense and difficult. And, pop culture is very much on the other end of the intellectual spectrum, as it were. Zombies and Cylons are typically associated with the other end of that spectrum. That in and of itself was a kind of novel idea. But we also thought that people who were enjoying these kinds of things, The Walking Dead, Game of Thrones, even Breaking Bad shows up in the book, right, would actually appreciate thinking a bit more through what these shows were trying to do and what they were talking about, and using Taylor as a lens for that. So we kind of meant it as a kind of introductory work in the same way, but using more pop culture stuff. And they loved it, actually.
Cool.
They were totally into it. They were really, really supportive. You know, I think we pitched it at them over a meal at some point, and then we kind of wrote up a proposal, and the whole thing moved along very, very quickly. So it was not as hard of a sell as you might imagine to the press. It's been maybe a bit more of a difficult sell to disciplinary political science, if you will.
Yeah, that's my next question.
Very happy.
Yeah, that's my next question, is how is this received by your colleagues? Because I can imagine them walking down the hall and kind of, you know, looking into your office saying, oh, that, you know, that's the zombie apocalypse guy now. We've had Chris Bader on the show a number of times, and he's become known as the Bigfoot guy in sociology. And you know, it's at a time that kind of stereotypes you, but other times you embrace it, and he says some really smart things about it. So I don't know, are people thinking about you as the apocalypse guy now?
Yeah, and actually, I mean, I get a lot more calls for interviews, like, when, you know, when the world was supposed to end a couple of weeks ago, you know, I get press calling me to talk about the end of the world and religious perspectives on the end of the world and that kind of thing, as much, if not more, than I get them calling me about, like, you know, religious freedom and foreign policy, which is kind of, you know, the sort of bread and butter of my latest book. So, I mean, sure. There's a little bit of there's a bit of skepticism there. The original title of the book, actually, which I totally lost the fight over, was The Politics of Apocalypse, A Popular Culture of the Malaise of Modernity, which would have been much more respectable for a CV, but the press just said, yeah, we're not touching that. That won't sell.
Yeah, no, I like that you went with the How to Survive the Apocalypse. It sounds like a handbook, actually, and I'm one of these kind of prepper guys, so I was like, oh, good, this will have a lot of information on what to store in my underground bunker, but it doesn't. It has a bunch of other things. One of the things that it does talk about is that the world is going to hell, and that's basically the pathway into your book. Is that the punchline of the book? The world's going to hell?
Yeah, I mean, it's the opening sort of provocative line of the book, and I mean, in some ways, you know, we're trying to grab people's attention, but we're also showing that, you know, there's nothing really especially contemporary about that kind of pessimistic sentiment. In fact, Alyssa has said, you know, we published this book now a couple of years ago, or a year and a half ago, I guess, and she said, you know, the book only gets more and more sort of contemporary the more time that passes. and I think she's right about that. And there is a sense in which, you know, every age has asked these kinds of basic questions about not only how the world will end, but also what in the ending of things the meaning of the here and now is. And that actually gets to the root of this kind of word apocalypse that we use. And so I think, you know, in a sense, that is the kind of punchline of the book. It's to get people to kind of peer into these apocalyptic stories and actually see nestled within them some of the big, very religious questions that so-called secular culture is really wrestling with right now.
Yeah, I do like that approach where you look backwards and say, you know, everybody in every generation says the world is going to hell. And as I grow older, I'm one of these old curmudgeons too. It's like, kids nowadays. But, you know, they were saying kids nowadays when I was a kid and even before then. So it is something that is streamed throughout history. It's also what you talk about, a lens into the here and now. Looking at the end of the world is something about the here and now. Explain that.
Yeah, so that, I mean, comes to the kind of Greek root of the word apocalypse. And I don't read ancient Greek, but happily my wife does, who's the better educated half of us. And the last book of the Christian Bible, you know, we typically call it Revelation. But actually the root of that word also has in it sort of apocalypse. And we play with that in the book as a way to kind of think about what's happening in some of these sort of pop culture dramas. Because typically, we associate apocalypse with just like this punishing end of the world, right? We think of a kind of Ragnarok, you know, an end of days. You know, even if we think, if we know anything about the Christian book of Revelation, there's just a lot of crazy stuff going on, but it's about, you know, stars falling to earth and, you know, devastation and destruction. But actually, I mean, the point of these dramas is not actually the punishing destruction. The point of these dramas is actually a revelation, which is the sort of other half of the kind of Greek root of this term, which is, you know, at the end of all things, the kind of curtain is pulled back and the true meaning of the things is revealed. And so apocalyptic literature, apocalyptic movies, television, whatever, there's always, in a sense, a deeply resonant religious sort of subtext there, because it's asking really basic questions about what the meaning of the here and now is. And in fact, the Christian book of Revelation is very much about that. It's forecasting this kind of end of the world scenario, but the message is a very contemporary one to Christians in the kind of first century living in the Roman Empire, which is take faith, right? You can have hope because in the book of Revelation, Christ is king. And that's a very contemporary kind of meaning-filled sort of confession. And I think a very similar set of questions, although obviously a very different set of answers, are being asked in contemporary modern, or you could even call them postmodern, apocalypses.
Now, you do start with Revelation, so you're taking it back about 2,000 years, give or take a century, and you stream this through history. There's a chapter in your book that details the short history of the apocalypse in about 15 or 20 pages. Run through that for us. How has the vision of apocalypse changed over time?
So, I mean, first of all, it's important to kind of recognize that apocalypse is not just a like Christian thing. I mean, I've mentioned the kind of, you know, the first century sort of Christian book of Revelation, but of course, most sort of, you know, religious and even philosophical traditions have a kind of reflection on either the end time or a kind of transformation that's sort of forthcoming. The Christian tradition has been perhaps especially prolific and has left a kind of special mark on the kind of North Atlantic or Western world for obvious reasons. But, I mean, actually, if you're looking at the kind of heyday of the apocalypse, probably one of the great sort of points in history to stop is the 13th century. And, you know, we talk about this in world history periodically, but there were things going on in the 13th and 14th century, you know, the invasion of the Mongols, the Black Death, you know, the massive depopulation of sort of, you know, huge regions of the world. You know, the great sack of Constantinople, the eradication of, you know, Baghdad by the Mongols, that a lot of people were saying, well, this is the end of the world. And in a sense, of course, they were right. It was the end of the world. It was the start of something very different that was about to begin. But it wasn't, you know, perhaps the kind of, you know, religious angels with their trumpets end of the world that they were expecting, though they might be forgiven for having thought so, given what they were living through. But the real sort of shift that we try to identify in the book is how we moved from, you know, a couple thousand years of reflecting on, you know, the end of the world, which was always kind of charged with this sort of religious or cosmic drama that was sort of taking shape, to conversations about apocalypse and very dystopian kinds of apocalypses, especially in the latter half of the 20th century, in which we're no longer kind of, you know, the people who are receiving the kind of, you know, cosmic end of this sort of apocalypse. But we're usually the actors. We're the people doing the apocalypse, right? And there is, in that sense, it's a very kind of anthropocentric shift, is what Taylor calls it, which is the apocalypse is no longer something that God or the gods or the universe is doing to us. It's actually something we do to ourselves. All of these stories have that kind of, all the stories we do with have that kind of anthropocentric shift in them. And some people, you know, identify that with the kind of advent of nuclear weapons, you know, climate change, these things that, you know, human beings have some agency in. And probably in the latter half of the 20th century, when we talk about the apocalypse, we're usually talking about something we've done or are doing to ourselves. And that's a real tangible shift than in the kind of 12th, 13th, and 14th century, for example, stuff that you'd find sort of outlined in the cathedral in Orvieto, you know, with these wonderful apocalypse frescoes, where there is an end being visited and a revelation being given, but it's being given. It's not being made by human beings, and they're not the architects of their own sort of end.
This might be a good time to talk about Charles Taylor. His name has come up a few times, and he wrote this large book, The Secular Age, and you had mentioned that you'd want to title your book The Malaise of Modernity, and that kind of all fits into this thinking. So give us a brief, if you could, summary of Charles Taylor's thoughts. Who is this guy, and what's he thinking about in terms of the secular age?
Right. So, yeah, the title we were thinking for the book was The Politics of Apocalypse. Taylor himself wrote a little book called The Malaise of Modernity. And actually, Charles Taylor, who is a sort of political philosopher, more or less retired now, but still teaches periodically at McGill, has written this sort of monumental book called A Secular Age. And actually, if you've read a bunch of other things that Taylor has written, you can find them nestled within this larger work, A Secular Age. In fact, when we first submitted our manuscript to the publisher, they said, well, you know, there's too many citations to A Secular Age in here, and we're nervous about, you know, copyright, so could you either kind of remove some of these citations or kind of, you know, move them around? And I said, oh, that's no problem. I said, I'll just cite any one of six other books, which are mostly folded also into A Secular Age, and there won't be any copyright problems. And they laughed about it, but it was true, because he's written a number of other little books that all kind of, you know, not quite copy and pasted, but more or less fit within this larger volume, A Secular Age. But the piece that we really used when we were trying as the kind of intellectual backbone for our book was the one that was published in Canada under the title The Malaise of Modernity. I think in the United States it's actually under the title The Ethics of Authenticity. And in that, he lays out what he calls sort of three pathologies of the modern moral order, where he argues, you know, look, we live in a different kind of time. And that time he defines, you know, as secular, which he means, you know, largely we have this optionality available to us now. Now there's this menu of cosmic options that human beings can kind of choose from in terms of what they think the larger meaning of the universe is. And that's a new thing. That kind of optionality is a kind of new sort of thing that's developed that's sort of unique to the North Atlantic world. And he says that there's a number of advantages that come with that sort of, you know, being, he calls it being disembedded from a kind of cosmic hierarchy. There are a number of advantages that come with that, he says, but there are also some peculiar disadvantages. And he names those as these three sort of pathologies. And we go through them, the book actually narratively sort of follows them in order. The one being kind of a kind of individualism, the second being a kind of utilitarianism, and the third being a kind of loss of freedom or a double loss of freedom. And we kind of trace those narratively through some of these dramas and pop culture artifacts to sort of demonstrate how that we also are struggling with these pathologies. This isn't just a political philosopher with his head in the clouds in Montreal talking abstractly about, you know, all these, you know, phenomenologists and, you know, people who have bequeathed, you know, North Atlantic culture. This is stuff that, you know, people in the everyday actually deal with. Taylor's got a great line on theory, actually. He says, you know, people were in the business of having a perspective on the world long before they got into the business of theorizing about it. You know, long before philosophers got credentialed PhDs and started, you know, dissecting these things in sort of, you know, academic ways, people had these kind of world and life views that just sort of told them how things went on and what the universe was like. And we still have those things, whether or not we sort of, you know, analyze them intellectually or not. And so this is his analysis, and we use that as the backbone for the book.
Yeah, let's talk about these three pathologies a little bit more. You say that your book is ordered by the narrative of it, and we're going to talk about your book a little bit out of sequence because I'm more focused on substantive things, looking for the ooky and kooky to the more commonplace, because one of the big surprises in your book was that it talked about Breaking Bad and Mad Men. And I read this, I go, that's not zombie apocalypse. That's just, you know, regular daytime soap opera drama kind of stuff. We'll figure out how that works in. But the first pathology is adrift in the cosmos. What's he talking about there?
So this is the idea that human beings are very much, we're sort of radically alone, as it were, and we need as individuals to kind of come to a full sense of moral maturity. We need to make our own choices about the meaning of the universe. And this is a fascinating, and by the way, you know, brewing and existent sort of mental health crisis in many ways, the idea that, you know, in order for one to have an authentic belief, to be authentic to yourself, you need to have kind of personally come to this set of conclusions. Often, by the way, without the benefit of history or tradition or parents, and I mean that both in a kind of literal genetic way, but also in a kind of historic philosophical way. And so we need to kind of make these choices about the world. And that this is what he calls a kind of, you know, radical individualism. You know, we use a couple of sort of stories to demonstrate what it might mean by that. And the first one we actually use is Battlestar Galactica, where we follow the story of Cylons, and the Cylons are adrift in the cosmos in a kind of very literal way, right? But they're asking this question about what does it mean to be us? What does it mean to be authentically Cylon? And the ironic conclusion of the series, well, maybe not ironic if you know its Mormon origins of kind of Battlestar Galactica, is that in the process of this radical individuality trying to express itself, there's a deep and recurring need for its recognition in other people, which is the reason they can't just genocidally sort of do away with the human species, which they attempt more than once in Battlestar Galactica. But there's a sense in which actually there's a kind of politics of recognition required in the background, that my individuality is only truly individual if other people recognize how authentic an individual it is. And the irony of that is just so rich and delicious, right? It's one of these tensions of the modern moral order. And that's the sort of first pathology that he talks about. And we use other sorts of dramas to demonstrate it too, but I myself love the Battlestar Galactica story.
Well, let's stick with this before we dive into the other pathologies, because maybe that's a better way of organizing this. But you bring in Battlestar Galactica. I was never a fan of the show, and I know there's two variants of it. There's the old one, I think from the early 80s, and then there's the present one, or contemporary one from the past decade or so. And give us a sense of the story. It's Mormon origins. That's a little bit surprising to me. And what is the general plot line that's going on here?
So, I mean, the general plot line is, in a sense, very familiar, you know, if you know about sort of, you know, apocalyptic technological stories. So human beings design robots. The robots eventually become, you know, sentient, and the robots rebel, and the robots kill the human beings. Right, and there are 12 colonies. There is a fascinating, actually, if you dig into this, there's a number of really great books on the kind of Mormon theology behind, you know, the trek in Battlestar Galactica. So I'll just leave that as a footnote for people that might want to Google that. I think that's very interesting. But then humans and Cylons, these robots that they created, kind of go on this chase across the universe to find their sort of the humans to sort of escape and find safe harbor. The Cylons to kind of, you know, complete their evolution as fully sort of sentient, fully kind of, you know, mature sort of creatures. But they're constantly battling against the backdrop of humanity that made them and their inability to measure maturity by anything other than what they know, which is, of course, humanity. And so they try to kill them, but they also need them. And then, of course, the sort of apex, and I don't want to give too many spoiler alerts, is the idea that at some point a Cylon human child becomes a possibility, and which is obviously the ultimate sort of recognition in the sense that there's a procreative recognition now between the two. And then, of course, there's a cycle of repetition in this, the idea being that actually this all took place in ancient history, and the new planet that the survivors found actually becomes Earth. And we now are the kind of, you know, hybrid sort of thousands of years on, generations, and we now are going through the same cycle, you know, developing technology, developing robots. Eventually, you know, they become sentient, there's a rebellion, et cetera, et cetera, and there's this kind of recurring cycle along the way. But aside from that kind of cyclical sort of technological, you know, almost deterministic apocalypse, it's this struggle for self and authentic self that very much defines the Battlestar Galactica series. I mean, that's the kind of thrumming, that's the kind of, you know, note behind the drama of the whole series.
Another movie that you bring up in respect to this, too, is the movie Her. And I saw it, you know, advertised when it came out, really not interested in that much. It's Joaquin Phoenix is featured in the film. How does this all play into it?
Yeah, I mean, Alyssa loves this movie, and I liked it too, but she really loved it and wrote quite a lot about it when she was both at Christianity Today and I think maybe when she was at Vox a little bit. But the idea is, again, you know, you asked other questions about, you know, the sort of suburban dramas of these other ones. The idea is that there is an end of the world in this movie, but the end of the world doesn't always look like, you know, airplanes falling out of the sky and, you know, cities blowing up. Sometimes, you know, the end of the world is a kind of transformation. And that's something that you sort of see at the end of the movie Her. There's this sort of sentience that's emerging amongst the kind of AI assistants. And it's very much a story about, you know, is this artificial intelligence? Who is this artificial intelligence? Are they human? You know, what is their relationship to the current humans? Everybody is, like, deeply alone. Like, one of the things that, you know, very, very quickly becomes apparent when you're watching the movie Her is that there is this kind of dystopian reality in which, you know, people have retreated to technology as kind of safe harbors, and no longer have the skills to really relate to each other in sort of normal human ways, but sort of rediscover those skills partly by relating to these emergingly sentient AIs. And then eventually these AIs, again, not a spoiler alert on her, but eventually they sort of band together and abandon humanity to kind of find out for themselves what they're about, and humans are left facing each other again. And so there is, in this sense, you know, it's not a kind of, you know, cities don't blow up, but there is a sense in which the world ends, it's transformed, and there's a revelation about what does it mean to be human? Who are we? You know, is there such a thing as an individual human? You know, this is, I think, one of the fictions that our modern apocalyptic stories tell us, this is in, like, in The Walking Dead, for example, that we only discover what it means to be human once we strip away our communities and our systems and our institutions and our polite sort of creature comforts that we associate with civilization, and then we'll see what human beings are really like, then we'll see how they really behave. But of course, you know, a guy like Aristotle would have argued, well, actually, communities are what it means to be human, right? Outside of the city, man is either beast or god. You know, so you strip those things away and you haven't suddenly discovered what authentic humanity is. You've actually stripped away humanity. It means to be in community. And I think that's one of the things you get out of the movie Her.
One of my favorite podcasts in the past year, of actually probably the entire series of Research on Religion, was with Matt Moore talking about Buddhism and the robo-apocalypse, and we'll link back to that for people who want to listen to it. But he, you know, he was thinking about this through the lens of Buddhist philosophy or Buddhist theology, and some of the politics behind us as we create these artificial intelligences, as we move to meld our brains with computers, we kind of have to think about how are we going to manage this as a society. Your book has the title, or as the subtitle, Politics is in there. So how does this Battlestar Galactica and the movie Her, how does this all play into politics?
I mean, everything, politics is sort of fundamental to the narrative, actually, because in a sense, you know, if we're all sort of on our individual authentic quest to realize our best selves and whatever that may be, and one of the sort of keys to that is recognition, actually, you end up, I mean, that ends up dominating political discourse. And, you know, you don't need to use very much imagination to think about how that is playing out in a society like the United States or in Canada, where it's not only important that people sort of authentically discover for themselves who they are, what they mean by, you know, their identity, their gender, their sexuality, or whatever else, it's also terribly important that other people recognize that politically, right? It's not just enough that we sort of, you know, have these, you know, individual ideas about it. It's very important that society recognizes that, and that we build the systems and the institutions and the laws that kind of, you know, coerce that recognition. And, you know, that's very much a kind of time and an order that we're in. And the politics of that become very complicated very, very, very quickly, particularly when it's sort of unclear, well, what are the backdrops, other than authenticity, other than you being sort of authentically true to yourself, what is the purpose of society? Does society just exist to kind of validate everybody's authentic expressions of their individuality? And if so, I mean, is that pretty thin stuff for society? Is there a common project? Is there a politics beyond just a bunch of kind of disembodied sort of individuals pursuing their own authenticity? And if there isn't a real commonness to that, or if we don't see a future for that commonness, I would argue that actually politics is in quite a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
and that, I mean, actually gets into the subsequent pathologies, right? Mm-hmm. Where if it's about your individuality and there's a utilitarianism associated with that, so things are only useful to me insofar as they further my sort of quest for authenticity, we end up with this double loss of freedom, which, you know, it's not very, you know, you don't have to go to Taylor to find this stuff. De Tocqueville talks about this. Frankly, so do Orwell and Huxley, right? The double loss of freedom, one is in Huxley and one is in Orwell, right? The one is we either amuse ourselves to death, right? We kind of forget the common project and it's all about, you know, ludically sort of pursuing our own individual sort of things, and the common project basically either atrophies to the point that you kind of default to a kind of soft tyranny, or you have a thicker kind of civil religious domination, which sort of is forced to kind of provide that kind of framework and stability. We actually talk about the Hunger Games, mm-hmm. In this respect, because You know, and by the way, I prefer Orwell and Huxley. I make my intro, poli-sci students read this stuff. But The Hunger Games has it too, right? It's either District 12 or the Capitol, but both are a kind of loss of freedom, right? District 12 is the kind of tyrannical, coercive loss of freedom that we normally associate with the loss of freedom, but the people in the Capitol have also lost their freedom, right? They're also slaves to their own sort of subjective desires and their sort of pursuit of authenticity. There's nothing common that drives them together anymore, and morality has more or less been abandoned, and so you have these kind of gladiatorial pursuits and this kind of thing, right? But somewhere in between probably lived the free society. But these are the enduring concerns. They're not just Taylor talks about. These are the enduring concerns since Alexis de Tocqueville visited the United States and said, hey, I see this possibly going one of two really bad directions, and they're probably going to have to guard against this. And that's as true today as I think it was when he wrote about it.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of The Hunger Games. I tried watching the first movie with my family and wasn't really thrilled with it. So again, you know, the contemporary stuff is difficult for me to wrap my head around, but you do mention Orwell or Huxley in there, which I'm much more familiar with. One other theme that you bring up here too that I think is related to this whole freedom's double bind thing is The Walking Dead. And again, I haven't watched the Walking Dead television series, but I'm a big zombie fan. Day of the Dead, Dawn of the Dead, Night of the Living Dead. We've had zombies on the show before, actually people talking about zombies, not actual zombies. But give us a little sense of how the zombie apocalypse, which is a huge genre right now, zombies are like the thing. So how does this all fit into it?
Sure. I mean, we love zombie stuff. I mean, I think in terms of apocalyptic narratives, going back to the kind of, Romero stuff, it's always been very political. The zombie apocalypse has always had deeply political kind of messaging behind it. And part of it is, you know, asking about, you know, what are human communities? What is a kind of just, you know, human community look like? Is, for example, something like Justice Possible? In the background of The Walking Dead, you know, you've got Thrasymachus from Plato's Dialogue, you know, constantly sort of rearing his head and saying, you know, justice is just the advantage of the stronger. You know, in some ways, I've described The Walking Dead to my students who will struggle to read something like, you know, the Melian Dialogue, for example, from Thucydides. You know, if, you know, the strong will do what they can and the weak will suffer what they must, I said, you know, you can just watch a season of The Walking Dead and you'll get what Thucydides was on about in the Melian Dialogue. Because there's a lot of sort of classic realism, sort of, you know, playing, as, you know, in a political sense, a classic sort of a realism rearing its head there. But then there are also these sort of, which is one of the reasons I like The Walking Dead and a few other shows, there are also these counterpoints and these notes that exist in the series. Taylor calls this, by the way, and I love this, this is actually probably one of my favorite takeaways from A Secular Age, he calls it the St. Francis of Assisi text.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, you know, you show me your, you know, really sophisticated theories and, you know, ivory tower sort of constructions about politics and so on and so forth. And if they can't make sense of St. Francis of Assisi, then they're not up to the real world. And I've always really liked that because, of course, St. Francis is a guy who's, you know, famous for having power and wealth. And a beautiful sort of, you know, umbrian countryside, and gives it all up so that he can live a life of sort of poverty and chastity and service to the most marginal. And there's a sense in which, you know, we have to be able to make sense of those kinds of choices. And, you know, The Walking Dead and some of these kind of more realist, inflected dramas, Game of Thrones, for example, sometimes has its St. Francis of Assisi counter note, but generally speaking, it struggles with that text. With that test. And I think that's a great test to bring to kind of, you know, zombie flicks and so on and so forth. I mean, is there something beyond mere survival that human beings are actually about? That's an apocalyptic question. That's an end of the world kind of question. And St. Francis is asking it. And I think, by the way, so is a lot of our pop culture and movies today.
Yeah. When you made that connection in the book, it just kind of, you know, blew my mind because you know Walking Dead zombies, and here's Saint Francis is, you know, the guy that has his arms out and the birds singing on his you know, arms and that kind of thing. You're like, how do you put these two together? But you do it pretty well, and it relates to, as you mentioned here, the issue of freedom and how we wrestle with authenticity and that. Explain Taylor's position on this pathology of freedom's double bind. We touched on it a little bit, but clarify it for us a little bit.
Yeah. So, I mean, Taylor, as with all of these pathologies, I mean, one of the things that I like about how he writes, and we try to write in that same spirit, is he says, you know, look, individualism, utilitarianism, this double loss of freedom, these are real pathologies, right? He doesn't want to say, oh, well, you know, these aren't real problems in modern society. No, he wants to say these are serious, you know, sort of existential crises in our culture. And we agree with them. And, you know, we try to show that by saying, look, and we're working out these crises everywhere in our popular stories and poems and songs and everything else. It's all about this stuff, right? How are we going to kind of get beyond this or whatever? But one of the things I like about the way Taylor treats these pathologies is he doesn't get sort of nostalgic about, oh, well, we used to never have these problems. It would be better if we were back in kind of, you know, medieval France. You know, he says, well, actually, there were problems there, too. and they also had a unique problems that were their own age, unique to their own age. But he says, you know, we don't want to ignore these problems, but there's also a way to kind of mitigate some of the worst abuses of these problems. And to be honest, I mean, in terms of this freedom double bind, the book that I've done on religious freedom, I actually think, you know, which is a Rutledge book and, you know, doesn't deal with zombies, but it does deal with part of this issue, which is, you know, how to think about social and political order amidst rival sort of cosmic visions for the good, right? That is a kind of religious freedom question, right? That's, I think, this sort of freedom double bind question, too, because one of the answers could be, well, everybody has their own sort of individual cosmic visions, and they go and pursue them, and politics is just making space for people to do that. And the other, of course, could be, well, that could never survive, so what we need is a much more sort of thicker, sort of civil religious kind of thing, and that will provide the kind of stability and framework within which people can have a more limited but still existent freedom to pursue some of these things. This is a very contemporary problem. I mean, here in Canada, a couple of years ago, we had our Charter of Quebec Values, which emerged in the province of Quebec. And the idea was people say, hey, there's all these newcomers coming into the province of Quebec, and they've got very different ideas about what the good life is, about what freedom and equality mean. And so we're not super comfortable with that, said the government of the time. And so we're going to create a charter that outlines what we mean by Quebecois values. And, you know, we're going to make those a bit thick. And I was critical of that charter at the time because I said, oh, I think that's pushing us a little bit on the kind of, you know, Orwellian end of the democratic spectrum, and I'd rather not land there. But on the other hand, we also see day in, day out, the consequences and the difficulties of an incredibly disconnected, disenchanted, sort of privatized and very individual electorate that is increasingly agnostic about a common political project. And that, too, can default into a kind of sort of soft tyranny. So I think what Taylor tries to argue in his book, and this is very much where we land in our book, too, is that those are real dangers. We're not ignoring them. They're serious. They're systemic. They're not going away anytime soon. There is a way to realize the best of some of those dangers, and there is a way to realize the worst of some of those dangers. And that's, I think, that's the contemporary political conversation in terms of, where are we going to land on some of these issues, and how are we going to treat some of these sort of historic values and even historic documents like constitutions that a secular age, you know, sometimes has less respect for than previous more kind of traditioned hierarchical ages?
Yeah, what you just said there kind of hits me like an atom bomb, because I happen to be working on my own research project that I call the Libertarian Club Conundrum, that wrestles with the similar kind of things about how you manage, radical individualism with the need to have some kind of social community providing some some economists have called ordered anarchy. So very cool. I'm going to be looking into some of this stuff, and I hadn't realized that. When you're talking about zombies and Cylons, we're all talking about the same thing. So very cool. The second pathology, which we're addressing here third, is this idea of efficiency as king. And this gets us to some of the movies or television series that you bring up that I would not have thought of in an apocalyptic sense. I think the three main ones you talk are Breaking Bad, Mad Men, and... House of Cards. House of Cards. And I looked at these. I said, man, again, soap opera dramas doesn't seem that way. And people have told me that I would like Breaking Bad, and they tell me what it's about, and I go, why would I like that? That doesn't sound, you know, I like it when, you know, Godzilla retreats into the ocean at the end and everybody's really happy because Godzilla turns out to be a good guy after all, right? Breaking Bad doesn't end very well. Spoiler alert there. But explain this whole idea of efficiency is king and tie it in with how Breaking Bad, Mad Men, and House of Cards are apocalyptic.
Yeah, you actually remind me of, I think, one of my favorite lines from Chesterton while we were writing this book, where he says, you know, I don't need fairy tales to tell me dragons exist. I know that they're real. I want fairy tales to tell me they can be killed. You know, yeah. And it's kind of a loose paraphrase there. And that's, you're right. I mean, some of these dramas are really dark. And especially in the second pathology, they get really dark. Because if you have a kind of utilitarian ethos, this kind of efficiency is king, then ethics kind of get suppressed under the kind of, you know, means justify the ends kind of logic. And then, of course, it becomes a question about ends, and that's why the first pathology is so important, because the end is, how can I achieve my own individual sort of goals? And if my individual goals are what are the most important, if being true to myself, if being authentic to the way that I think I should be is the most important goal, then actually social ethics become downright pathological, right? People and systems and society become tools to help me kind of express who I am or achieve the goals that I've set for myself. And that's a very worrying sort of trend. And so, you know, you look at things like Breaking Bad or House of Cards, and what you see there is, I think you see a kind of breakdown of ethics, which is a kind of apocalyptic thing, right? I mean, House of Cards has a kind of, you know, apocalyptic tone to it, because all of the systems and institutions that we've come to associate with good democracy in the United States, the checks and balances, for example, that were designed by people who I think had some insight into the human condition, are all sort of corralled into this sort of, you know, quest for power. And what we find is that, you know what, no set of institutions, is so bulletproof, is so capable of surviving a kind of breakdown in, you know, individual morality or a breakdown in sort of social consciousness. There is no such system, and I think, you know, this is often a helpful thing for political scientists to sometimes remember, who can get very kind of, you know, wrapped up in our systems and our institutions. And I mean, I love this kind of thing too. But at the end of the day, you know, there is no system or institution that can be designed that can protect against, you know, wide-scale sort of social tyranny, which is what I'd call radical individualism. No institution can survive that, no matter how sophisticated that it is. Ultimately, you know, individual virtue, the sense of kind of social consciousness and other regardedness, is fundamental to any sort of properly functioning society. Jonathan Chaplin, a favorite political theorist of mine who works out of Cambridge, says, that liberal democracy depends on virtues that it can't legislate. You know, and that's true. We need these kind of Burkean little platoons kind of operating around, justifying, you know, why it is that we'd have other regarding virtue. Because liberalism itself doesn't have a lot of that kind of, you know, normative kind of, you know, religious kind of justification. So I think that's true, and I think these stories are an example of what happens to our kind of systems and institutions when we kind of adopt this utilitarian ethos. We mow them down. They can't survive it. In other words, virtue is still actually fundamental to a free society, especially other regarding virtue. And if we lose the sources of other regarding virtue, one of the primary sources of which I would call actually religion and religious communities, I don't care how sophisticated your secular institutions that you've designed are, they won't survive that kind of collapse.
Mm-hmm. Now, I would I second that, and I'm listening to you talk about this stuff, and you're approaching it from a more political theory angle, and I'm approaching it from a political economy angle, which is absolutely fascinating. Just give us a sense, though, of Breaking Bad and Mad Men and House of Cards, if you could summarize those series and how they work in, because I'm familiar with Breaking Bad, but Mad Men, when it said it's talking about 1950s advertising executives, I'm like, I'm out of here. I have no idea what actually transpired throughout the, you know, several years that it ran. And House of Cards, I just, you know, I do political science in the day. I don't want to do it at night, you know. So
yeah, I actually understand that.
Yeah. So give it. Have you watched those series?
Yeah, I have. So the one, I mean, Alyssa and I kind of split up some of the chapters. So she watched. She did some of the stuff on Breaking Bad and Mad Men. She loved Mad Men. I knew a bit. I watched House of Cards. I haven't completely kept up with some of the new stuff, but the book was published a little while ago now. But I mean, I actually love the historic angle of Mad Men, because one of the things that I think we wanted to show in the book is that, you know, this isn't just a, like, you know, these aren't just like post 9/11 or post Cold War kind of problems. These are enduring systemic things that actually have their root in ideas and practices. That aren't just like, you know, it's not just the kids these days. Is, I think, what we were trying to kind of, you know, say, oh, you know, shucks, you know, they're all sort of stuck on their iPhones, and if only they'd kind of get their eyes out of their cell phones, they'd see that, you know, we've built this beautiful society. Well, actually, this beautiful society had some really big problems before the kids today came along. And the kids today may have a lot of unique variations on some of those problems, but actually, fundamentally, individualism, utilitarianism, freedom is double-blind, you know what, that's not the kids' problem, that's parents' and grandparents' problem. That's society's problem. It's an intergenerational series of problems.
Yeah, yeah. It's a human problem. Yeah, human problem going back to humankind, right? Yeah.
Exactly. And you know, the scale and intensity of them may be a little bit different in the modern age, and the notes may be a little different generationally, but they're similar in a sense. And so we liked including Mad Men because among the things that showed that, you know, these pathologies are not just contemporary stuff. And it sort of showed the kind of historical development, if you will. But I mean, I also want to be cautious because, you know, Game of Thrones, for example, will sort of jump in here. But I mean, House of Cards is an example too. People said, oh yeah, well, you know, this is an example of, you know, the stuff we see around us and whatever else. And it's like, no, these are dystopian dramas, right? They are the kind of radical, logical, not even, but they're the radical conclusion. They don't have to be the logical conclusion. They're a possible conclusion, a possible dystopian conclusion. But, I mean, if, for example, American politics or medieval Europe actually functioned the way that Game of Thrones or House of Cards shows it to be functioning, there would be no society. Right.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
You know, you have to have people who grow crops. You know, you have to have, you know, people have to be able to eat. There have to be these sort of functioning elements. And so these shows exaggerate the dystopian elements. And I actually think they're interesting and helpful for that reason. But I get nervous whenever people say, oh, yeah, well, House of Cards, that's what we live in right now. I mean, that's not true either or helpful, because what it does is it precludes and obscures the sort of functional bits that still are worth kind of, you know, fighting for. You know, Augustine would say, you know, we may be working among the ruins, but among those ruins, there are real things that are actually sort of helpful and sort of hopeful and so on and so forth. These shows, that's less the case, but that's why they're shows. That's why they're stories, right? They help us kind of game out these sort of dystopian fantasies. But they're not a kind of, you know, copy and paste of reality. I mean, that would be crazy. You know, society could function under the kind of, you know, utilitarian kind of bind that Game of Thrones works under, for example. And I think that's important to keep in mind.
So I just have to ask this for my own clarification. I know Breaking Bad is a story about a high school teacher who gets into the world of making drugs and the drug underworld and doesn't turn out well. House of Cards is just a you know, general political drama following a president through the malaise of every society's malaises. But Mad Men, what, I mean, how does this devolve into a dystopian? I literally have no concept of what this show is about.
I mean, it's about the occlusion of ethics, for sure. People doing whatever it takes to kind of get what they want. It's about defining what you want, right? And it's about desire. And by the way, I mean, I think one of the most fascinating things that Aristotle and Augustine can teach us, and this is in Taylor's The Secular Age, too, although I myself would just send people to Augustine and Aristotle on this, it's about the shaping of desire too, right? We're not just born with desires for certain kinds of things. I mean, I think there are kind of, you know, certain kinds of desires that are nestled in there, but the advertising industry is about the manufacture of desire. You know, it's about the manufacture of, you know, wants that sort of end up defining us. And the neat part about that is we think, you know, we sort of disembodied or disembedded modern and postmodern selves want to imagine that all of these desires about who we are and what we want to be, they're all authentic to us. They're all, you know, the most individual they could ever be. You know, in most cases, you know, we're all slaves, you know, and as Kane said, and, you know, his famous quote, you know, to some defunct philosopher or, in the case of Mad Men, advertising executive, right? You know, we think this is who we are and what we want, but actually, you know, there's been this script that's been forming our desire for a very long time, often in sort of pre-theoretical sorts of ways. We've just been kind of osmotically sort of absorbing this stuff. I much prefer, and I love this line in Alistair McIntyre's After Virtue, we are never more, we're often less than the half authors of our own stories. And I think that's always true, whether we recognize it or not, in terms of what we receive, both from our parents and the culture and the recognition around us. And that's why I think advertising as a kind of drama for Mad Men is a great kind of trope for us, because it's about the manufacture of the desire that we think is authentic to ourselves, but actually is being driven by a whole range of other things.
All right, I have to pause here and give you one last question, but also make the observation is that you're our first guest to ever use the words osmotically, authenticity, and then weave together Plato, Aristotle, Augustine, Huxley, Orwell, Charles Taylor, and The Walking Dead and Battlestar Galactica. Wow. I mean, people might look at your book and say, oh, it's just kind of a goofy pop culture thing, but there's a lot of heft to this book, and it is a very, very fun read. We're going to point people back to it. Just a fantastic book. So congratulations on that book. But here's my concluding question to you, because I'd love to ask this of all my guests, and recognize that scholarship is not a destination. It's not a book that lands on somebody's desk. It obviously does that, but it's a journey for the people who actually are studying the topic. Along the way of doing this book and working with Alyssa, is there anything that you had an aha moment or you changed your mind about the way you view things? Tell us about the journey a little bit.
I think when we started digging into these shows, we were a little bit, I think, cynical. You know, that we thought, oh, man, you know. I mean, one of the questions we were asking about ourselves is, why are we so drawn to some of these shows? Right? Some of these things are awful. You know, I mean, my wife certainly thinks so. But, I mean, some of them are just sort of, you know, these dystopian things are sort of objectively difficult to watch. But we kept kind of recurring to them over and over again. And, you know, we're like, you know, are the questions of theodicy? Like, what is it that's kind of capturing us in terms of, you know, why we keep coming back to this? And I think one of the things we ended up concluding was that these stories, these movies and television shows, they felt like they were the kind of almost sort of spiritual cries of a kind of, you know, secular generation that wanted to know what the meaning of stuff was. In fact, if anything, one of the things we ended up with more charity and more empathy, because Some of the questions that are underneath these shows and the pathologies that sort of connect from Taylor to these shows, they are so painful. You know, I had a student reading some of this stuff, and she was kind of doing some, you know, index work alongside the book and so on and so forth. And she came to me one day after she was reading this, after she was reading, you know, a little bit of Taylor. I didn't inflict too much of it on her, but then also looking at some of these shows and everything else. And she said to me, I think I finally understand why it is I feel so alone. And, you know, why it is that I just, you know, feel like I can't get ahead of this kind of, like, tidal wave of isolation that sort of seems to permeate my existence as a kind of, like, in her case at the time, like, 18-year-old. And I thought, man, that's even different from how I grew up. You know, I grew up with the personal computer, I like to say. So I didn't really have them. As I came of age, so also did the sort of personal computer. I didn't have things like the internet when I was in elementary school. It sort of barely existed as a shadow of itself in high school. And I thought, man, that actually gave me insight into students. I mean, this book actually started as a lecture in my intro IR course. I taught about realism through the zombie apocalypse, which is, of course, what Dan Dresner does, too. But eventually, all the different art forms sort of came together and the lecture sort of became the book. But it started that way partly because of conversations with students. And I think, so if anything, one of the real sort of, I don't know, shocking conclusions, but one of the sort of startling conclusions we came to was a real sense of empathy for the students that we're teaching and the way that they are kind of existentially struggling through, really, I mean, life's deepest questions, but in our day and age, not only without the benefit, but there's almost a sense in which there's some shame associated with sort of simply accepting what your parents tell you or simply continuing what you've been taught. You know, you have to almost, in a sense, sort of critically deconstruct and destroy what your parents have given you. And then only maybe you might come back to it, but with a different perspective. And I think, man, that puts a burden on young people in a way in which it's hard to imagine other histories or places ever having it in the same way. You know, at the same time as they're finding out, who am I? What are my skills? What's my job going to be? How am I going to make money and all this stuff? But then I also have to be fully authentic to myself. I think that's, you know, that to me, that almost explains, you know, the brewing mental health crisis in 17 and 18-year-olds right there. It's crazy. And without the benefit of the past, you know, don't go read Augustine's Confessions. Don't go read Plato, because that's just what a bunch of old sort of, you know, dead guys have said. Be authentic to yourself. That's crazy. You know, we've expected them to make sense of the universe and rob them of the pathway to get there. So, I mean, that's one of the things I was really left with, this deep sense of empathy for the students that I teach.
Wow, yeah, the kids today, the kids yesterday, the kids 100 years ago, and the kids in the future, I guess. They'll have to be battling the Cylons to make sure we get to our planet Earth once again. Fantastic read, fantastic insights that just pull from everywhere. I thoroughly recommend that folks pick up the book, How to Survive the Zombie Apocalypse, as well as your other stuff, because it all does tie together, and we'll be happy to have you on a podcast here in the future talking about religious liberty. But today, my guest has been Robert Joustra. Robert, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.